time to take a look at the world of insects today. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network, and really pleased to welcome back Phil Pelletieri. Phil, distinguished faculty associate emeritus professor from the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison, retired as the head of the Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. He stops by every couple of months to talk about insects. So we'll look at biting gnats, mosquitoes, Japanese beetles, and many more insects. And certainly we're inviting your questions and comments as we move along. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And if you have a photo, an insect photo, maybe an ID that you want, you've got an insect, you wonder what it is, or maybe just a really pretty shot of an insect. We always love to see those. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Phil, welcome back.
Nice to be back.
I tell you what, here we are getting into the, here's the first day of summer, I guess.
Yes.
Slowly but surely seeing some insects come out. I was playing a little golf last night and around dusk and found that there are plenty of mosquitoes still out there. But this is the time when those really nasty bugs can come out, isn't it?
Yeah, in fact, just looking perspective-wise, I've been a little surprised the mosquitoes, at least in the Madison area and the like, has not been as bad as I was anticipating, considering how wet it was in the spring. But the other one picked up during the turkey season and whatnot, the black flies, at least in southwestern Wisconsin, had a very good year. And I have a dear friend who does a lot of bluebird work, and when we get mass emergence of black flies, he has almost 100% brood failure. It's a species that comes off the Wisconsin River, and they're not too far from that. And so this, again, was not a good year, unfortunately. And it didn't surprise us because, for about 2 weeks, you could not go outside. And it's interesting. Most of those are bird-feeding species, so they wouldn't necessarily bite you, but they'd still, get in your eyes and everything else and just be a general nuisance. So it was not a good year for that spring flush of black flies, at least in parts of the state.
Yeah. Well, one of the pests that have been bothering, those biting gnats and the black flies, maybe talk a little bit about those insects. What are they like?
Well, black flies need moving water to breed. And so if you get far away from streams and rivers, you would think you'd be okay. But interesting enough, sometimes we have documented them blowing 30, 40, 50 miles from the site they were breeding and still messing with people. So you can get kind of this on again, off again. Pretty much day biters. Real interesting, they don't come indoors, or if they do come indoors, they don't bite. I just got back from Canada, and we had one really bad black fly day, and a bunch of them followed us into the cabin, but they just sat on the window. They're not, their behavior is not to feed. Now, the other biting gnat, what we sometimes refer to as no-see-ems, have a very different life cycle. They tend to breed in mucky, swampy stuff, and are such wimpy flyers that, honestly, unless you're very close by and you're out at dusk and dawn, you usually don't have a lot of problems with them. And so they're kind of more localized. But the whole game here with all those biting flies is that they utilize the blood that they steal from you to make eggs. And that's the way they work.
And, you think about it, if one of those can blow in from 50 miles away, I'm thinking about control, there's...
And moving water poses a real problem, because even if you had something that was selective, and there are some bacterial insecticides that are rather selective, but you put it in the top of the stream and it just washes down.
Yeah.
And so it really poses, again, a very difficult situation, and you're constantly getting emergent and blowing in. And so, as I said, it is not something that has lent itself really to any good, spray programs or whatnot that really are going to make much of a difference.
In terms of the mosquitoes that I mentioned, I didn't put any repellent on last night. I just didn't want to. I thought I was nearing the end of my round, and so I thought, the heck with it, I'll just fight it. But you're saying that the mosquito season is not as
bad. It depends where you are. I consider this a really wet spring, and if you've got more standing water, that tends to flush it. And so historically, we've kind of set the clock that the wave is going to come a little before Memorial Day if it's a very warm spring, and a little later if it's a cold spring. And I thought it was a little bit on the cool side and wet, and I'm waiting. I would say a couple weeks before that, I was out turkey hunting, and I had more mosquitoes in my blind than I've ever remember. But it was just that little wave. And as I said, we've been out gardening, and you know, a little bother, but not what I was expecting. And unfortunately, with the big problem mosquitoes that we have, they're related to flooding rains. And so if you get some standing water and it sits for 10 days, it's really about a 2 week to 3 week process from when the floods come to when you get the wave of mosquitoes. And so you can get multiple waves if you get those kind of weather patterns in the summer.
You know, just sort of in general, last week I was in Sheboygan, and the week before I was in Appleton, so I was doing a little bit of driving where I'm on the road a few hours. And I can think in past years, my windshield would be just dotted with insects, and I'm just not seeing as many on my car, and that's kind of, you know, I kind of worry about that in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and we've had that question before on the show a number of times. And, you know, I'm a little perplexed. But on the other hand, when I'm driving around, I don't get thumped in the windshield as much as I used to. And, you know, typically a lot of that stuff were the bigger moths, you know, the cutworms and whatnot. And there really is not a lot of evidence. You know, you can speculate if you're in ag areas because there's not near the diversity that there used to be out in the landscape, that could affect a little bit of it. But on the other hand, you know, once you get near any bodies of water, they have so many insects that breed them, you would expect it to be. And, you know, it is related to temperature and wind and a few other things that come into mind. But I know what you're saying. It just doesn't seem, but I don't know of any empirical data to say, well, you know, the insects are down or whatnot. It's just kind of a reference. And, it's kind of an interesting observation.
Well, we've got lots of callers online, so let's take some calls. David and Madison up first. David, thanks for calling. What's on your mind? David, are you there? I am not hearing David at all. So let's try another call. Let's go to Ann. Ann in Milwaukee.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
I've got a new kind of bug this year that I seem to have a lot of, and I don't ever remember these before in such numbers, and I notice them mostly outside. They're really small. They're only about a millimeter in size, maybe smaller, oval-shaped. They seem to scurry around. They can jump small distances. They don't seem to have wings, and I notice them on flat, like, colored surfaces, like concrete and walls and siding, and now because my windows are open, I'm noticing some inside my house, and I'm just wondering what they are.
So the giveaway to me is that they hop, because there's a group of creatures we refer to as springtails. They live in the soil, they feed on organic matter, and then they come out, and they are wingless, and you get sometimes incredible emergences. I mean, to the point that it looks like a science fiction movie. There's so many little bugs crawling around, and again, it refers to a little bit of the richness of the soil. If you've got bark mulch and other things, that would probably set up conditions they like a little bit better. But definitely nothing to worry about. I mean, they don't hurt plants. They don't bite. Anything that comes indoors is going to die in a relatively short period of time. But when we get these tremendous emergences, it's quite common after new construction where you've disturbed the soil and whatnot that you get them, you know, a half inch deep every morning around the foundation. And then when you see those kind of things, people get quite frustrated. But you know, if you spray, you kill what's in front of you, but more come. So I really wouldn't worry about it. In what I suspect, you know, if we get into a drier period, their numbers are going to go down. And it would be quite unusual to have large numbers of springtails for the whole summer season. I mean, it's usually kind of a 2 or 3 week phenomenon, and then all of a sudden they disappear. And it may be an extended period of time before you see these emergences again. It's almost like it's a population explosion, and some people have speculated that they're trying to get up out of the soil and disperse to go to greener pastures. I don't know if that, sometimes that story fits, sometimes it doesn't, but as I said, definitely nothing to worry about, and tend to be more common after wet periods just because, you know, those prevent them. They die when it's dry is what happens.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense with the wet, so thank you.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks a lot for calling. All right, Maddie and DePere. Yeah, it's your turn. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. I have a couple questions. One is, before Memorial Day, I was out in the cemetery in De Pere area out in the country, and I got a bite. I didn't even realize that I had that bite between my eye and my temple. And but then when I got back in my car, I happened to touch that area, and there was blood on my finger. So I looked in the mirror, and there was a pretty good chunk out of my skin. And within, I would say, a half hour, there was a red ring around it, maybe an inch around, all the way around it. And then within an hour, there was my whole right side of my face, of my cheek, was red and swollen, and it took several days to go away. And I have a niece who lives not too far from there, and she's had four of those bites. I'm 75 years old, and I never experienced anything like that in my life. Mm-hmm. My question is, what kind of bug would that be? Does it carry any kind of diseases? Sure. And my second question is, it was reported on the news that there was a four-year-old child out in Oregon who was, paralyzed. She couldn't move her arms and her legs. And they found a dog tick, which is, my understanding, is the same as a wood tick. Mm-hmm. And when they took it out, a few days later, she could walk again.
Sure.
Like I say, I'm 75 years old. I never heard of anything like that before.
Okay. Yeah. Well, for the tick story, there is a syndrome called tick paralysis, and it is caused by dog ticks, typically when they bite in the neck area. And there is apparently some body, immune response to the presence of the tick. And when the tick is removed, people, recover very quickly. And so it's not overly common. I don't think we totally understand it. I mean, it's an individual sensitivity to it, but it's not something typical. Most of us can get bit by wood ticks, and even if it's in the neck area, you don't expect that. But that is not that unusual. You can see it quite commonly in the medical literature. Now, back to your bite. I'm just speculating, but the two things that make me think it was a black fly is, one, the blood presence. Yeah. Secondly, not feeling it when it happens. And third, really, when black flies bite, they literally multiply stab you. And so you do get a chunk if you think about it. Now, when they're doing that, they're injecting saliva that both prevents you from feeling the bite, also makes the blood flow. It's an anticoagulant. So they're pumping all this strange stuff into your system. And depending on where it is and your individual sensitivity, you can have a dramatic reaction. Now, yours is really maybe much more than you normally expect, but not out of the possible realm of what you would get. And as they said, so it's a bit of your sensitivity to its saliva. But, the bite on the head, that's pretty typical. As I said, the trickle of blood is classic.
Yeah.
I've had people tell me their eye, almost swells shut because of a reaction to it. So those all fit. And then the kind of number of days. I mean, when you do get this, people that get the welts and other things that, it's not uncommon for it to take quite some time to kind of resolve. But the good news is no disease.
Yeah.
Not in this country. In other parts of the world, black flies do have a significant issue with human and animal diseases, but it really is not something that we worry about in the U.S.
Yeah. That's, I'm no insect expert, but that black fly was the first thing I thought of because I've had similar instances, and I knew they were black flies because I saw them, and so there you go, Maddie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, UW-Madison Associate Emeritus Faculty Member. Well, yeah, I guess we can call him that for sure. At the University of Wisconsin-Madison, our guest here on Garden Talk, here on Insect Talk on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn gets caught up in the latest efforts to put forward a health care bill in the United States Senate. That's at 2. Right now, taking a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. Join in with your own questions at 800-642-1234. Shoot us a photo or a question on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, or call 1-800-642-1234. And on to Holly in Madison next. Hi, Holly. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I think you may have answered my question already, though, while I was waiting. I have been taking my dogs this summer to Viking Park in Stoughton, and there is a body of water there. It's rather quickly running. I don't know what body of water that is, if it's a river. I'm assuming it's a river of some sort. But my I have two large dogs, and one of them has been having bites, noticeable, huge, giant bites on the back of his neck and sometimes on the rest of his body. And I've only seen, the only thing I've ever seen near them is flies that I shoot away, but I haven't seen anything long enough to actually bite him. So that's confusing, but they're giant bug bites. The vet confirmed that that's what they were. And my other dog, though, it seems completely unbothered. So are those black flies that are biting my dog? Is he just a reactor to that?
I have a question. Are they different? Are your dogs, what are your dogs' coat colors? Are they different?
They're both Great Danes, but they do have different coat colors. My boy is the one that's bitten has, they call it blue. It's like a silver gray. Mm-hmm. And then my female is black and white. Oh. And she doesn't seem bothered. But my boy, oh my gosh, they're horrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in particular this year, the way I've seen things unfold, you know, the gnats are so small. They're like a fruit fly. In size, and so they're so easily overlooked, and a lot of times they can get down and start to feed, and you really don't notice they're there is part of the problem. You know, later in the season, the stable fly is notorious for picking on dogs, but, you know, that's as big as a house fly. The bite is very painful. You know, you can see them buzzing around real easily on the dog. And, you know, in bad years, they're really tough, and particularly on the ears of dogs and some of the places where they... almost the same as black flies. It's kind of a multiple stab wound and cause a lot of irritation. But as I said, considering the severe reaction and the like, and it may just be, again, the individual differences in your dogs as far as how they react to those salivary compounds, because that's what you see in people. I mean, some people tend to get very large, you know, welts the size of a nickel that evolve out of the bites, and other people really get very little at all in reactions other than that initial maybe trickle of blood if the black flies are allowed to feed long enough to get it to there.
I wondered about, the reason I brought up color was I just wondered if they might be attracted to different colors.
You know, there is, much like mosquitoes, darker colors often are more attractive to these biting creatures. But, you know, it's kind of a relative thing. It's weird. And as I said, one of the other interesting aspects is, as a family, the multiple species of black flies, they are typically considered more bird feeders. So really, birds have more problems than people. And we get these odd associations where one species will particularly feed on birds and all of a sudden take a switch, although I think evidence is now suggesting what we have here is a number of different species that just look alike, and until we had the DNA technology to separate them out, entomologists thought we had the same thing. But, you know, you hear those kind of stories of something changing its behavior. That's not really typical of most insects.
So can I ask, I use a prophylaxis on them for ticks and mosquitoes. Is it for mosquitoes? I know it's for ticks. No, it's got to be for mosquitoes. It's heartworm. But so that doesn't seem to be having any effect. And would it? I mean,
yeah, no, you wouldn't expect. You know, so the case with mosquitoes, mosquitoes can still bite, but they can't transmit the heartworm. That's what it kills. With ticks, because of the long feeding pattern, you know, a number of days, you can get more of a response. But these are kind of a hit-and-run type of feeder, so there really isn't a whole lot that helps there. You know, technically, repellents would probably help a little bit. You know, the other thing is if you can plan your days out on good windy days and whatnot, because they're relatively weak flyers, you're less inclined to be bothered. You know, some people talk about dusk and dawn, but it's more related to wind speed, I see, as far as... And I've seen black flies be bothersome at 10 to 50 miles hours of wind, you know, so even though it's relative speaking, some days you think it's windy enough and it really isn't.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks, Holly, for calling. Ann in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Ann.
Hello, I'd like to know if there's any research done on the Citrosa, geranium, and other plants that garden centers sell as mosquito deterrents or repellents, And if the plant itself is unattractive or repellent to mosquitoes, but how does that translate to actually protecting, for example, people on a patio area?
Yeah, so it's one of these things that's kind of a half-truth. There are various plants that contain chemicals that if you extract them and then expose mosquitoes to it, they are repelled. But in the case of these citrus and citronella and the like, the only way it works is if the leaf is crushed and these chemicals are released. So when it's in the plant and not disturbed at all, it really doesn't pose any kind of repellency to it. So as I said, it's catnip's another one. Catnip has got some very interesting chemicals that are really good repellents, but only if the chemicals are extracted and then put on like you would DEET or citronella or you know, the various other repellents. So as I said, it's kind of a half-truth to it. And unfortunately, unless you crush the leaves, it's not going to do you any good.
So the mosquitoes won't probably bother the plant.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's an interesting question, too. Those chemicals have other uses. They're usually, the plant are using them for defense against other insects, because, of course, mosquitoes are not a factor there. But this interesting interaction. And so there really are a lot of natural plant compounds that have some mosquito repellency. But with all the research and the like, as people looking for it, you know, the common citronella-based products, you know, the DEET, which is you know, a synthetic-based, and picaridin, which is a kind of a European repellent that's now moved into the U.S. market. But you will get, you know, various things, and, you know, they differ really in how long they repel the mosquitoes more than anything else. So, but, yeah, I remember back, you know, when I was a kid, you used to read about in the back of the newspaper, you know, you could buy these special magic mosquito plants. But as I said, once I became an entomologist, I understood that they really weren't being up front with you.
There we go. Thanks, Anne.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And Miles in Milwaukee next. Hi, Miles.
Hey, Larry. How's it going?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I got a question for Phil about tiger beetles in the southeastern region of Wisconsin.
Okay.
Basically, I was on the beach a couple weeks ago chasing down Sex guttata and Rotunda, and I happened upon an entomologist, Matthew Bruss, from the University of Nebraska, and he was showing me one of the Rotunda that I thought I had found, but it was actually Lumbalis. So my question is, what types of tiger beetles can be found around the Milwaukee area, just so I can, you know, kind of help with future misidentification?
Sure. There is an exquisite sight, and you will appreciate this, I think, because you understand how hard it is to chase out tiger beetles. It is the tiger beetles of Wisconsin, and the person who put it together, and unfortunately his name slips me now, he started with doing butterflies, taking pictures of all the butterflies and giving all the information of when they're out, what kind of habitat, you know, where they've been found in the state. Then he moved on to tiger beetles, and what is fascinating about it is he took all the pictures himself, and you know how hard it is to get up close and personal with a tiger beetle with a camera, and now he's evolved into robber flies. So, you know, it's just fascinating to me he has the patience and the skill to put this together, but he has done a very nice piece. And as I said, if you search tiger beetles of Wisconsin, he's up in the North Appleton area. And as I said, he's a retired teacher, but he is a heck of a photographer. And that will get you everything you need to know as far as the species that have been seen. He'll give you some hints as far as, you know, separations of ones. And by the range maps, you'll be able to see what's in the southeast and what's not.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. And Paul in Madison, we'll move to you next. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Phil. I built a large screened-in cage, and I'm thinking of putting some potted swamp milkweed plants inside it and a male and a female monarch butterfly and hopefully raising them through their life cycle with the neighborhood kids. Is this something that's viable? And I did it before with some polyphemus and some cecropias when my kids were young, and that was a tremendous experience.
I mean, what may be, because it's a little hard to sex them on the wing and whatnot, if you can get three or four monarchs and put them in there and keep them captive, or if you're lucky enough when you're out walking to see small larvae and import them. So it's interesting. I know down in the Iowa area, they literally have kits that they sell to people for a similar type of thing. It's basically a cage system. You plant the milkweed. And, you know, the advantage of this system is that you are preventing many of the predators, not all of them, but many of the predators. So you have a higher success rate in getting the caterpillars through in getting adult butterflies. And so, I think it's a great idea. the whole question is finding the monarchs. And this year, I have been pleasantly surprised. I saw my first monarch about the 15th of May, and have seen a number of them since then. You know, in some years, it seems it's not until July we see them up here. So
yeah.
I think just with the way the weather patterns have, is we got a pretty good push this spring, which suggests we're going to have a more successful season in Wisconsin than maybe we've had in a while. Because they said so much of it depends on when those first monarchs get here. And this year, as I said, I was sitting in a turkey blind, and I saw one coming by, and the milkweeds were already up. And I said I was amazed to see that much activity that early.
Yeah, I mean, really interesting. We had the author of a book on butterflies on the show here, and now I'm forgetting the name of the title. Maybe Chris can find it for me. But that was a fascinating book. And the milkweed plant itself puts out something to deter the monarch, and how the monarch overcomes that is really, really fascinating.
Yeah, milkweed has relatively few animals that feed on it, you know, which is the plant defense. But then once you get past it, you know, of course, the monarch can pull chemicals out from the milkweed to help protect it. And yeah, it is just a interesting dance of nature. And again, it's so exciting to me. I was disappointed years ago, excuse me, when the monarch didn't make the Wisconsin state insect, because it is it is such a great creature, you know, that we all remember and easily identify with. And of course, now with all the interest in the population problems that they've been having in Mexico in particular, it's just kind of neat to see people really kind of take up the cause and see what we can do for the critter.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot, Paul. Appreciate your call. Turn to the Facebook page. Phil, you want to take a look at an insect visitor posts here, wondering what this is.
It looks to be an ichneumonid wasp. Now, this is a huge family of parasitic wasps. They're all basically parasitic on insects of one sort or another. Some have very long egg-laying devices, which usually means they're going after various wood borers. Other ones attack caterpillars and the like. And so even though they're technically a wasp, they're not a stinging wasp. They don't live in colonies, as I said. They are parasites, or what we officially call parasitoids, which is an insect parasite of another insect.
Black with long antennae.
Yeah, long antennae. And in many of the species, as I said, will have some kind of what appears to be a stinger, but it's their egg-laying device, which they use to insert the eggs into their prey.
Hmm. Here's another photo, this one from Hannah. Pulled those out of her greenhouse.
Okay, so what's fascinating here is there, I think, two things going on here. And she does mention that the chrysalis is of a butterfly, Red Admiral in this case. The caterpillar itself is one of the Noctuid moths. I think is the zebra caterpillar, if I remember correctly. And very colorful, but the adult moth is rather drab and such. But
she's
got it. I see there. She's got it identified, yes. So that's a great photo.
Yellow with these black stripes.
And the little red feet, you know.
And little red feet.
as I said, and that's the fascinating thing with many of these insects is that, you know, the larvae, of course, are such a different-looking creature. But again, how amazingly colored they can be in one form and then the adults. But that's kind of typical. You know, moths really don't need to be colorful because they find each other chemically and are basically active at night. Butterflies are more visual creatures, and they need to be very showy to attract their mates.
Let's go to Justin in Rio next. Hi, Justin.
Hey, Larry. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, my wife and kids the other day grabbed one of these bugs and put it in a jar, and they showed it to me one night, and I was looking at it, I was like, well, that's pretty cool. And then I set up about 2 hours trying to figure out what kind of bug this is. I posted it on your website. And then the next day, the picture I actually took is on my truck the next day, because I let this one go after I think I identified it anyway. But I saw another one, so I was kind of interested. I believe this is a white-spotted sawyer, a longhorn beetle.
Mm-hmm.
And which was interesting because I found out about the invasive Asian beetle.
Yes.
The difference between the two with the little white spot in between their wings.
Mm-hmm.
What my question is to you, Larry, or to your guy there, how do those guys get into the tree with their long antennae and be able to get in there without damaging such long antennas?
Well, it works the other way. So white spotted sawyers, and there's really three species you could bump into the state, two rather common ones, attack pines, in some cases firs, and spruces, but it's more pines in particular and firs. And what happens is the female injects her eggs under the bark, and the grubs then develop and take upwards of a couple years to develop. You can literally hear them chewing, and they typically attack dying and stressed trees. Okay. And then we get the adults coming out are you know, kind of scary looking because their size and those long antennae, but they never need to burrow underneath the tree to raise their young. It's a common insect we see emerging from log and rustic furniture because that's not kiln-dried wood. We also see it emerging from log homes again, if the logs were not properly cared for when they were cut, these insects will even lay their eggs as the logs are sitting on the ground under the bark and the like. And as I said, they burrow in. And so I've had some interesting cases over my career dealing with pine sawyers making noise and pushing sawdust out. But the good thing about the wood is once the wood dries, they can't get back in it. So it's not something that continues to recycle. And as you found out, you know, they are almost dead ringers for the Asian longhorn beetle. Which has not been officially found in Wisconsin. And but this is a native insect that attacks dead and dying trees, where the Asian longhorn beetle is a non-native insect that is very aggressive on maples in particular and a few other trees. And, you know, they've had problems in Illinois. It's basically the big problem. It's been in the Northeast fighting that. And it looks like, unfortunately, that it's here to stay. I mean, the area that is infested is way too big to expect any eradication to go on now. So something we have to keep our guard open. But in the scheme of things, it is even the Asian longhorn beetle seems to be much less aggressive than something like the ash borer, emerald ash borer, because you know, it's easier to detect. It's got a longer life cycle. There's a few things about its biology that makes it a little easier to manipulate. But yeah, the pine sawyer, it's a neat creature. You know, the antennae of the males can be 2 inches long. So as they said, it's impressive, large. Those dots on the back make it a nice photographic subject. You can get it in. That represents a very large number of beetle family. We call the cerambycids or longhorn wood borers. And in general, they tend to be rather colorful creatures. Not most of them, not near as big as this one, but as I said, for that reason, they're really quite popular with collectors.
Mm.
So, are these actually white spotted sawyers that I got on here, or is that a pine sawyer? I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah, it probably is white spotted Monocamus. Boy, species name slips me right. Scutellaris is the most common one we see. But there are a couple other sawyers you can get, particularly in northern Wisconsin, where you've got a few more, you know, native firs and the like being present. And, you know, one place to go, and this is one of these cases where if you were to try to separate them and get some good pictures of it, there's a site called Bug Guide. And it basically is a database of pictures that people throw together, and, you know, you could help identifying things. But what's nice about it, if you know the group of insects you're looking at, so if you look at sawyers, you'll be able to see the, you know, probably 6 or 7 species of sawyers in North America and see various comparisons and the like. So it's a great site when you kind of know what you want. If you're starting from scratch, I got this bug, what the heck is it? This is way too big of a database to wade through. But as I said, that might be a good one if you're trying to separate it just to see some pictures.
I found the photo that Justin put up.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's probably white spotted sawyer. I can't, you know, I'd like to see it up a little more close and personal to be sure, but by far that is the most common one. But as I said, interesting enough, there are a couple other ones if you really get technical.
All right.
Very neat bug. Yeah, thank you for your answering my question.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Al and Seymour next. Al, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm trying to locate off-the-shelf product to use for the wood ticks and the deer ticks that you can spray on your clothes, and
sure.
I'm not finding anything.
Well, the problem, there's basically two products. And you think they're the same, but they're not. So the classic repellents are DEET-based products. They're mosquito sprays. They do repel ticks, but they don't kill them. They're
DEET,
yeah,
right?
But you don't want DEET, okay? If you're serious about ticks, you're looking for permethrin as the active ingredient. And so what you tend to find is you go to a drugstore, they got all the DEET repellents and no permethrin. If you tend to go to an outdoor store, you know, something like a sporting goods store or somebody that, you know, outfits people that like to go camping and whatnot, they will have permethrin-based products. I know Sawyer is one brand name of permethrin. There's also some Repel products that have permethrin. I am sure there are multiple other products, but they're sold as a repellent, but the difference is twofold. One, they're only for putting on clothes, not on you. But second, they're not a repellent. They kill the tick. So the whole concept is you spray your clothes, the tick crawls on it. It will not die instantly, but it will die in a matter of a few minutes before it has any chance to cause any problems. And many of these products will last through washings, you know, three or four washings. So they're really, you know, long-lasting products, unlike DEET, which basically you can even sweat off in a period of a couple hours. So side by side, although DEET is pretty good, permethrin's much better.
Yeah.
Can you spell permethrin for me?
P-E-R-M-I-T-H-R-I-N. So look for that active ingredient. And as I said, many brand names. The one I know has at REI is Sawyer, S-A-W-Y-E-R. I like that one in particular because it's a hand pump you can get. You don't even have to have aerosol.
I found one at Gander Mountain, too, that with a hand pump that really works well.
Yeah, you know, and the labels say, you know, spray your clothes when they're not on your person, let it dry, and then put it on. What I'm not a fan of, and, I like to bow hunt and other things, and I get on these discussion boards. You can find all kinds of permethrin at the garden store for spraying on your garden plants. You can find other stuff for killing termites and the like. And what people don't understand is, aside from it being illegal to use it in a manner that the label doesn't allow, is that they're formulating this for different stuff. So the people that are putting the termite spray for treating your home on their clothing are really taking a big risk because it wasn't made for that purpose. The concentrations are different. The carriers are different. So as they said, this is a classic where you go and buy the right stuff and you're sure you're not going to have any problems.
Al, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Marty in Douglas County. On to you now. Hi, Marty.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Phil. I have a question, but two quick observations. I see that Interstate 35, which runs from Duluth to Laredo, Texas, is being designated Monarch Highway. They're going to be planting plants to encourage monarch populations. So that was some really great news recently about monarchs. We had a wonderful little experience last week. We're able to get up close and personal with a pair of Cecropia moths that were mating. And if a person has never seen a Cecropia moth, it was phenomenal. These things have neon orange fuzzy legs and like a checkerboard pattern on their abdomen. It's like orange and white. We couldn't. It was so amazing. We could have picked them up and carried them around because obviously they were very distracted. That was so cool, though. Okay, so here's my question. There is this new tick-borne disease. Public Radio did a big hour-long program last week about tick-borne diseases. Douglas County, I believe, has the second highest population of people who have had Lyme, yours truly and my husband included. This new deer tick disease causes really severe brain illnesses, seizures, including it can kill you. I heard something that I'm praying isn't true, that it only takes 15 minutes for that tick to be on you to transmit this disease. Please reassure me that that is not true. And what else can you say about this?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's kind of a new ball game. So, you know, deer ticks have been associated with three or four bacteria in related organisms. One, in fact, is more closely related to malaria. And with all those organisms, it takes a long time for the tick to transmit. So the whole thing about getting the tick off within 24 hours and you're protected. But this Powassian virus, which is, I'm sure, the one that you're referring to, is a whole different ballgame. It's a virus, first of all, so there really is no standard treatments. And from what we understand, it's a much quicker transmission. Now, I'm not sure about the 15 minutes. I have not been keeping up with this as much as the research has been going on. But I do know it's a much quicker transmission in a much more complicated story because all these other ones we know are rodent-borne diseases that the tick acquires and then can transmit the next time it feeds. This one is more complicated than that. And as I said, the good news seems to be that from what I'm aware of, most people that get exposed to don't have complications. But those that do have complications, as I said, it really, mortality factors and everything else, it's a more dangerous disease than Lyme and anaplasmosis and ehrlichiosis and babesiosis, which are the other deer tick transmitted diseases. And the classic of all these diseases historically have been the northwest part of the state, has been the hottest area, kind of the focal point, and then things have kind of over time spread out from those areas.
Marty, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Chris Molina, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow, I will be driving to Lambeau Field in Green Bay, and you are invited to join me. You're not going to want to miss this special event I'm hosting at Lambeau Field tomorrow in Green Bay. We'll spend the evening exploring Packers history with team president Mark Murphy and historian Cliff Crystal. We'll have a tailgate-style reception right afterwards. It's going to be a lot of fun. Family-friendly centennial event in Green Bay. You can still get tickets for it available on our centennial website. And for our website, it's WPR.org/100. WPR.org/100. WPR and the Packers. Doesn't get much more Wisconsin than that. And doesn't get much more Wisconsin than Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, retired from the Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him along to talk about the world of insects. And Phil, we were talking about monarchs earlier. I mentioned a book. That book is called Monarchs and Milkweed, A Migrating Butterfly, A Poisonous Plant, and Their Remarkable Story of Coevolution. Anurag Agrawal is the author, and he's a smart, smart guy. We had a lot of fun talking with him about that. Dave in Wausau up next. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good morning. Phil and Larry, I love it when you two guys get together. I listen to your show all the time. I'm going to open a discussion up and ask Phil for a primer on the horsefly. I'll give all the old farmers up here in Marathon County something to laugh at. The city slicker here afraid of horseflies. It seems they are just amazing this year. I don't remember ever being this thick. I'm sitting by the side of the road making this call in a white delivery van, and it sounds like it's raining out right now. They're hitting my truck so hard. And so often, so maybe a primer on them. Is there anything any kind of disease they typically carry? And should I really be afraid of them, Phil?
Sure. Well, the bite hurts. I mean, that's enough to be making people to go indoors. So the family tabanids are the deer flies and horse flies. The bigger ones are referred to as horse flies. The smaller ones that have banded wings are the deer flies. And we have combine probably 30 plus species in the state. The larvae are predaceous and live in swampy type areas. So you need wetlands somewhere close by and don't cause any harm, but the adults are blood feeders and they are day biting, extremely fast flying critters. And there is even one, the black horsefly, which honestly is about an inch and a half long. Thank goodness it doesn't mess with people, but it really ravages horses. So they're very visual. And you notice, as you say, with your truck, anything that moves. So, you commonly get people say, I went up to my cabin and, I was driving down the driveway and there was just this cloud following the car. The movement is what draws them in. And you see the same phenomenon when you're out. The more you swat and whatnot, honestly, the more you attract is the bad news about it. But they tend to really prefer to be out in the open. So they're patrolling along the edges of woods and whatnot, where if you think about it, that's where the deer step out to feed and the like, and so that's where they're more likely to find prey. Usually, if you get in a shaded area, they really are far less likely to mess with you. They just don't like confined areas and the like. Don't respond really very well to repellents because it's such a quick hit and run type of reaction, where most of the other blood feeding flies are kind of using chemicals when they get close to you to really determine if you're something to feed. The horsefly, again, it's if you're moving. And they have not lent themselves other than land use changes. And, we're trying to preserve wetlands, not get rid of them. So that's not going to work. But it's not like some other flies that have particular resting areas and whatnot that you can manipulate and treat to kill them. These things are just kind of always on the move. Now, years ago, and I don't know if it's still on the market, there is a horsefly trap. And when you look at it, it's a most amazing, it's just this dark, big beach ball-like object that sits and swings under a tripod. And when the flies see the movement, they come in, but when they get close enough, they realize it's nothing to eat. And so they put kind of like a funnel on the top. So the flies fly up into the funnel and get caught. And interesting enough, it does over time reduce the number of flies out in a pasture or other areas. It was originally developed by USDA. I know we had worked with a person up in the northeast part of the state who kind of commercially developed them, although that was a number of years ago, and I just haven't come up to if he's still marketing. But there are probably other designs out there, and you could build one yourself if you think of it. So it's a way of getting partial revenge, but unfortunately, when you think about going to a lake home or other place that you might run into these things, there really is not a whole lot that helps other than keeping a hat on. Unfortunately, just about the time that the deer flies and horse flies stop chasing you around is when the mosquitoes come out.
Yeah.
So it's not a fair trade-off, unfortunately.
Oh, boy. Thanks a lot for calling. Ron in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I have a few questions. I've lived in La Crosse area for many years. Of course, we're in the Mississippi River Valley. But years ago, we used to have a lot more insects, but that also included mosquitoes. Now, the number of mosquitoes has declined to practically nothing. I've hardly been bit past few summers. And we don't get as many of the mayflies we used to get, nor back in the 1950s, we used to have a fair number of dragonflies. We had so many insects like moths that used to flutter around the old incandescent street lamps. In fact, back in the 50s, I remember, maybe Larry could remember this, years ago, back in the 50s, they used to have insect screens on the, you could buy insect screen to put on the grill of your car.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, you know, and Larry and I were kind of throwing that around. It just is kind of an interesting phenomena that it is not unusual. I've had this question a number of times over the years on the show of people saying the same thing. I just don't see the number of insects on the front of my car as I did before. And as I said, you know, other than equating it to land use changes, as agriculture has gotten, more expansive in the diversity in the landscape has lessened. But that doesn't make sense in a river valley where, you know, typically things haven't changed that much. But I'm not aware of any solid data to show where we were at one point versus now in how that has changed, and especially in a large landscape type scale, which is usually what I think we're talking about here.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Ron. And Ann in Brookfield, we'll give you a shot. Hi, Ann.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to just share an interesting story. I was out digging in soil in my yard a week or so ago, and it was at dusk, and I noticed something glowing in the soil. And it was a little larva, about less than an inch long, and it had plates on it. It was kind of flattened, mottled brown, and its tail end lit up, which was pretty cool to see. And so I looked it up online, and it appears to be possibly the larva of a lightning bug. And I didn't realize that those were the things that were called glowworms, and it said that too. And it said that for some species that eggs light up too, and so I was wondering if our resident lightning bugs here actually have eggs that light up.
Not that I'm aware of. Now, there really is two families of beetles that luminesce, and they're closely related, but they don't look very much alike. There is a family that we technically call the glowworms, the phengotids. The larvae light up, but the males don't even look like a beetle. They're the most bizarre-looking things. In fact, we used to trick our graduate students. That was a classic. Bring this bug in. What is it? And it doesn't look like a beetle. And you know, but that's just being a mean entomologist, I guess. But going back to, so the glowworms, the females never mature into adult insects. They stay in the larva form stage. Now, the fireflies, which is another family of beetles, have both in the adult stage where the males and females use the flashing of light to find each other, but there is luminescence or light making in some of the larvae also. But I'm not aware of any eggs. There may be, I definitely wouldn't consider myself a total expert on fireflies. And more often than not, the glowworms are the ones that I tend to see people find many of the firefly larvae that I find don't luminesce, but they do in the adult stage. It's the same mechanism that they're using is an oxidation and reduction of a protein that generates a light, and it's so energy efficient that, again, people have always marveled, and we've used that technology now in the last few years as a way of producing light. Back when I was a kid, they used to, in fact, pay you a nickel for every 100 fireflies you'd send off to Penn State as they were trying to understand this mechanism. They needed a bunch of fireflies to be able to extract enough of this chemical. But, you know, back to the glowworms, what's interesting, if they're happy, they make light. If you start to bother them, it doesn't go off instantly, but in a matter of a minute or two, it will fade. And then again, when they're happy. And so I used to tease, it was almost like a mood ring that they used to have, that the color would change depending on what was going on. So predators, in the case of glowworms, they tend to be predators a lot on millipedes, and in fireflies, slugs, and some other things in their larval stage, among other insects. And we just got into, my wife reported her first firefly about 2 weeks ago. I wasn't lucky enough to see my first firefly until about a week ago or so, but we're getting
seen
in the season
yet.
It's coming on. I usually think about the 4th of July. We're really starting to take off with things on fireflies.
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, it was really neat to see something glowing in the soil. I thought it was something shining, and it was really,
really?
About, you know, some larva. It was very cool.
Very cool.
Often you see them, you know, in bushes and mulch, that kind of area. Not so happy out in our lawn grass because that's really kind of a desert as far as insects are concerned. But, so, you know, you're more likely to find it in a forested area, those kind of things where you've got a little bit more diversity, a little bit more litter for them to develop in.
And thanks a lot for calling, Ann. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, as we talk the world of insects, we'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Phil. Stay with us. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, former UW Insect Diagnostic Lab head. Great to have him along. I'm Larry Mueller, and glad to have you listening in as well. We've been getting lots of great photos on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. If you want to take a look, you're going to see some dandy photos. And, of course, we're getting calls. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us as well at ideas@wpr.org. And we were talking about glowworms earlier, Phil, and Jonathan sent us a photo of a fluorescent green glowworm, I think.
Yeah, that's it, no question. I mean, the color is classic. You see the light really more in the intersegmental membranes between the plates, if you think of it, on the insect is kind of typical. I'm amazed that I've seen this picture more than once that people have taken and what techniques it takes to be able to get that color to come out. Although, of course, with new cameras, it's amazing what
Jonathan,
people can take.
Yeah, he did a nice job on that. Chris in Sorona has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
Well, I'm a beginner beekeeper. I've been at it about 3 years, and last year I lost my hive to a bear attack, and I put my stuff on a three-season porch, and now I'm cleaning out my frame, and I have web on top of the comb, which I think are wax moths, and when I'm scraping them, I have little white larvae I can see, and they're alive. And I also am wondering if mites would live in my box without any bees in there. So I'm getting them ready to store so I can start again next year. And does he have any advice?
Well, for waxworms,
wax moths.
Yeah, but the larvae are referred to as waxworms, and they typically are more of a problem in colonies that are in decline or not active. There is a bacterial insecticide that is used to kill the larvae, among other things. I'm sure there are some physical methods you can apply too. I would not expect the mites to be able to survive that extended period of time without active bees in the colony. But it's an interesting thing. They use waxworms. There's a big industry in the state that rears these for fishing bait, among other things. And I also read an article recently where they have been found that they can digest certain types of plastic which is really quite interesting and exciting because they're looking at, again, as a way of recycling. But unfortunately, when you get them in your frames, as I said, they can be quite destructive as they kind of burrow through and chew on things. So, as I said, the one bacteria product I remember that was registered for it, it's very selective. It only kills caterpillars. That's why it can be used around bees. So that is one of the options of cleaning it up.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Well, here's an amazing photo on our Facebook page. It looks like a ball of insects.
Yeah, it's a bee swarm. And a honeybee swarm.
From Amy, yeah.
And it's really the only true swarm. You know, when I think of a swarm, it's this congregation of bees. And what it is this is a group of bees that have left their colony and are looking for a new home. And so this is kind of a short-term, let's hang out here until we find some place to move into. And there are scout bees literally out searching. And when they find a hollow tree or another appropriate place, they will communicate that to the colony, and they'll pick up lock, stock, and barrel. So, you know, one of the things when you see a swarm, they're really very non-aggressive in this form. There's really no hive to protect, and that's when bees are tend to be the most aggressive. It usually is a phenomenon that will go on for a few hours to a couple, 3 days at best. And beekeepers love to hear about swarms because they can collect these bees with a queen and start a colony. And so this is a way of them, you know, naturally kind of expanding the number of hives that they have. And And one of the interesting things to me is that when the mite problems really got going in the state, for the longest time, I would never get swarm calls. It's particular from wild bees that are swarming. But in the last 10 to 15 years, things have really changed. It's become more commonplace. Now, the swarms could be coming from a commercial beekeeper that wasn't managing his colonies properly. But many of these swarms were from wild ones. And I had a conversation with Marla Spivak, who's up at the University of Minnesota and a honeybee expert in the Midwest, about the issue that we are starting to find that our wild honeybees have developed some resistance to the mites. And this is evidence of that, is that typically if they were susceptible and not treated, they would die out. But now they are surviving, which suggests they have some natural resistance. And so, as I said, I think that's a good sign that we're seeing a lot more swarms, that things are starting to balance out a little bit. So.
Well, that is a very, very cool photo. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Look under posts, and you'll see it. It's something else. Nancy and Madison, thanks for waiting. Hello.
I love when you have Phil on. There's so much to learn.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, my question is, I have been trying to grow kale for the last couple of years unsuccessfully because something eats it. All that's left on the leaves now is the vein of the leaf. Everything's gone in it, and they eat it so quick it's gone in a day. And the only thing I see around it, I look at the leaves, I see nothing on it, and it's not an animal.
You've got it fenced off.
I do. So it's not an animal. The only thing I've seen is a white kind of butterfly moth thing.
Sure. So that is the parent of the little green worms that are notorious for cabbage, kale, broccoli, and they're so well camouflaged that when they're small, honestly, unless you get really close and look at them, you're not going to see them. But they are eating machines, and so that would be my first guess. If these were very young transplants, flea beetles can sometimes really decimate them. But on bigger plants, they don't eat to the. You see all these little pepper holes in the leaves, but they don't take it right down to the vein, which is that is classic of again the imported cabbage worm is what we call that butterfly.
What do I do?
There are some organic products, both a bacterial product and a product called spinosad, which are registered for use on broccoli, kale, and the like. And usually, what we suggest is don't spray or treat until you see the first white butterflies in the spring. Unfortunately, they're out there right away. I mean, and then you can start treating. And they will lay their eggs, but the larvae will die very quickly before they get much of a chance to do much. Typically, as the summer goes on, it gets worse, not better. Is my take, is that often you can get early cabbage and broccoli and kale through, but once you get to this time and later, if you do not treat, I expect for them to be able to find it. And one of the things I love about this story, I use this quite commonly when I was teaching, is the dynamics between plants and insects. So if we tried to feed most of the things in the cabbage family to most insects, they die. And the reason they do is there's natural mustard oils, which is a plant defense. Well, of course, my little green worms have figured out not to die. They're not poisoned by it. But now we find that mustard oils are the way that the white butterfly finds out where to lay its eggs. So it has taken that natural defense and turned it 180 degrees, uses it a way of finding its host plants. And if you think of it, it's also smart on the butterfly's part because it's got no competition. Anything else that tries to eat the kale plant isn't going to make it. And so, as I said, it's really an interesting story in its own right.
Well, I don't know if it'll come back. I mean, now there's hardly anything left, but it happened like in a day.
Yeah. No, they're fast. You know, typically, you know, larvae of many insects will eat 3 to 4 times their body weight a day. So when they're little tiny insects, that's not much. When you're an inch long worm or inch and a half long worm, you can extrapolate a couple of those on a plant, and it is an amazing amount of food that they're taking out in a very short period of time.
Okay, so spinosus, you say?
Spinosad is Dr. Jack's dead bug brew is one of the common names it's sold under. The other ones are the various bacterial products for treating vegetables. That is
organic. Though.
Yeah, it's both those are organic.
Oh, yep.
Thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks for calling. And David in Osseo, it's your turn. Hi, David.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I got a problem here. I got thousands of these little bugs on my white rose bushes. That's our main attraction. Every year, as soon as the weather gets warm, they come up.
Little wormy-like and things?
They go back into the... And then when they're done, they go into the ground. If you knock them off, they try to burrow in the ground. I'm thinking there must be a poison I can put in the ground to keep them, to get rid of them.
So this is a greenish bug with a stripe on its back?
Yeah. I'm thinking, so the most common early season critter on roses, we call a rose slug, and the name's deceptive. It's not a slug. It's technically a sawfly, which is a caterpillar-like creature, and they usually show up in colonies. So it's not one, it's a whole bunch. And you're right. The way they transform is to burrow in the ground and spin cocoons, and the next critters come out. But it's hard to poison the ground because it turns out the organic matter and whatnot really affects the performance of things. What I would suggest is there are various sprays. And again, if you want to go organic, that same spinosad product we talked about for the kale protection would work here, as would many garden insecticides. But to me, the magic date is somewhere around the 20th of May. Because that's when I know they're laying their eggs and the little green worms start. And if you slam the door there, you'll be much more satisfied. If you wait till we get this late, you can kill the bugs, but they've already done the damage. Now, the good news is it's cosmetic. I mean, I've never seen these kill roses, but they make them look very shabby. And it will affect flower performance as you're losing leaves. So I'm not going to say it's not has an ill effect, but relatively speaking, at least it's not life or death. But somehow you have to remind yourself to treat because it's predictable when they're going to show, which is rather typical of most insects. I'm a big proponent that if the insects got the better of you this year, somehow on a gardening catalog, you have to mark to look at the plants 2 weeks earlier next year to see if you can intervene before there's really the kind of damage that you'd prefer not to have.
Yeah, good advice. Thank you for calling, David. Appreciate it. Lewis in Manitowish Waters. Hello, thank you for calling.
Hi. I heard you guys talking about the absence of bugs on your windshield as you're driving your cars. One of the reasons for that is the aerodynamic design of a car today versus the older models a few years ago. As the car goes into the motion of hitting the air, the aerodynamics of the car pushes the air above the hood and over the windshield and over the car. And that's why cars are more economical today and you get fewer bugs on your windshield.
I like that explanation because, as I had mentioned, I've always been confused because I've never seen any empirical data say that there's necessarily less bugs. You just see less spots on your windows, and that makes a whole lot of sense to me.
Yeah, that does. Thank you, Lewis.
Okay, you're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Kate in Sauk City. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have some milkweed plants with no bugs on them yet, but I know that last year they did become covered. Is there anything I can do now to prevent those bugs from taking over?
No, only because they come flying in. You know, it's not as if there's something you can do on a localized area that's going to make a difference. Now, even though they look quite dramatic, you know, they're affecting the seed, because they're a seed feeding insect more than anything else. They really don't compete with the monarchs. They just lessen the viability of the seed if there's a lot of them. So they're really not a serious problem. You know, soapy water would kill the immature stages, but what makes me a little nervous there is that soapy water was probably going to be pretty nasty on very young monarchs and other things that you might want to have on the plant. So as I said, it's hard to be selective here. I've got things that can kill caterpillars and not kill the bugs. I don't think off the top I can think of something that just kills the bugs and not the caterpillars. So
It's not really going to kill the plant then? I shouldn't worry about them?
No, as I said, you'll see as the season goes on, they tend to cluster along the pods as they develop. And that's what they are. They're a seed-feeding insect. And they feed a little bit on the sap, but not enough to deter the plant. And so, very visual, being red like they are, or orangish-red. And you always find them in herds. There's never, one or two when they start right. breeding. So
there we go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Cher on Facebook wonders if there's a way to predict when the fish flies will erupt along the Mississippi River.
Boy, if you were present in sampling the water, possibly yes. But I have never seen, an exact calendar date or whatnot of when you're going to get this mass emergence. And some years you don't get the mass emergence. So, it all typically happens within a 2 or 3 week period because it is water temperature induced, among other things. But I don't know of any exact predictor other than, again, getting your nose down in the water and seeing the larvae develop and getting ready to emerge.
Gene in Appleton next. Hi, Gene.
Hi. I'm calling about the plight of the bumblebees, the actual large bumblebees.
Mm-hmm.
This year and last year, they've just lessened to the point where it's scary, and they're so sweet and so nice, and I don't think they ever sting. First of all, where do they live? Are they ground, or are they just looking for an opportune place to build a nest? Are they solitary? And what is happening to them?
Sure. So the true bumblebee is a colony form. So it has a queen and multiple workers. It starts the spring as a queen, and typically they're in ground areas of cavities, old rodent burrows, washed out areas under rocks. Although I have seen them in bird nests. I have seen them in bird houses. But the typical place is in ground. And as the summer goes, the numbers get bigger because the queen's laying eggs, raising workers. And then in the fall year, they die off. And we have about 14 or so species of bumblebees that have been seen in the state. And if you get on the internet, you will find that in the last 10 to 15 years, there's a handful of species that are disappearing on us extremely quickly. I think the biggest theory is that there are some diseases that are hurting them. There are other species that are not affected by the diseases, although some of these are not technically native bumblebees. We've got some bumblebees from Europe that have established here. So, it is interchanging. In fact, one of the species is even on the endangered species list, and people are trying to do some things to bring that one back. But as I said, in the scheme of things, it appears that there have been some diseases introduced that are really tough on particular species of bumblebees, and that's what's causing the decline.
Thank you again for calling. Terry sent us an interesting photo. He bought a blacklight to catch cabbage worms in the evening, and he posted a photo where you put that black light on the plant and they really stand out at night.
Interesting. Now, typically, people who want to collect moths use black light type bulbs because the frequency, light frequencies, are more attractive than the standard incandescent bulbs. In fact, one of the things they'll do is they'll shine this on a white sheet so you've got this big beacon for moths and whatnot to come in. So as I said, my friends that are serious moth collectors, that is one of their main ways of catching things. Now, on the other hand, because you're getting a different lighting system, people talk about spider eyes glowing. And you see all kinds of neat stuff when you're using different light frequencies. That's a really amazing picture.
And here's a video wondering if you can identify what this is. Let's see.
Ah, okay.
It looks like long antennae sticking
right.
out.
So the animal is referred to as a horsehair worm. And it is a parasite of insects, in particular
really
crickets
cool.
and grasshoppers. And it will. This was inside one of those and burrowed inside. And as you can imagine, it didn't do a whole lot of good for the cricket. You often see horsehair worms after a rain. They look scary. They look like they could be parasites of your dogs and cats and whatnot, but they're not. They're insect parasites. The reference seems to be from the fact that people used to believe that if you put a horsehair in a bucket of water, it would transform into a living worm. What probably happened is a grasshopper or a cricket fell in when these horsehairs worms emerged. And if I remember right, many of them need an aquatic life stage. There's this very interesting interaction. But if you haven't seen one, it is bizarre because they're 3 inches long and very skinny, very nervous type creatures. And as I said, what you have witnessed is something that came out of a cricket or a grasshopper, most typically, although there's some other insects they can get into, but that's their favorites.
That was great. Alex posted a great video of it, so go take a look on our Facebook page. You mentioned crickets, and Todd emailed to say he hasn't heard any crickets yet this year, and his wife claims they don't come out till August. I don't remember this being the case, but is she correct?
Well, there's two different kinds of crickets. Well, no, there's more than two different kinds, but there is a spring singing cricket that overwinters as an adult, so it's ready to go. But the more typical crickets I think we all associate, crickets are only really chirping when they're adults. So when they're immatures and in growing, they're not. And so the late summer is the second wave. It's a different group of species in most cases. So you can both be right. But typically you tend to hear more crickets, I think, later summer than you do in the spring. But if you're out in the right place, don't be surprised that, as I said, even in May, there will be crickets chirping.
Jason in Manitowoc. Hi.
Hello. I was wondering if you have any ideas on how to deal with rose chafers that wouldn't be too detrimental to honeybees.
Sure. So I don't like the technique for Japanese beetle, but I do think it has some merit for rose chafer. There are traps, the Japanese beetle trap, that they sell, but instead of using the Japanese beetle attractant, they use a rose chafer attractant. And what they do is they come into the baffle, they bounce into it, and they're collected in a bag. Now, the only people that have trouble with rose chafers are those who live in sandy areas of the state. This insect is not found in heavier soils. But the problem they present is they're flying into your yard from areas around you. So it's not as if I could say, do this, and they'll go away on your yard, because they're not coming from your yard. And so the concept here is if you buy a couple, three of these traps and place them away from the garden, you don't want to place them next to the garden because it's drawing the things in, you can catch a whole bunch of rose chafers without affecting anything else. The problem is to find the traps, because Japanese beetle is all over the place. It's a big market. Rose chafer is very small. And the only place that I was aware of that was selling it was called Great Lakes IPM. It's a company out of Michigan. You can mail order the traps. The other side of that, though, is that I would like to see you have the traps and have them set up by the first week of June, because typically rose chafer comes on in mid-June. By the time you get the traps this year, I'm thinking it's going to be towards the tail end of the season, so you're not going to gain that much on it. But, as I said, we're not fans of Japanese beetle traps from the research to stop Japanese beetles from affecting your plants, but we've seen more evidence that the rose chafer traps do lessen the amount of damage that you have on things. So, as I said, that would be the direction I would go.
All right. Thanks very much. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And, boy, here we are once again out of time, Phil. It flew by. Have you done anything with your book yet, or are you making progress?
I honestly made great progress in the winter. So the rule is, if there's snow on the ground, I write. If I'm not, I made a whole lot of progress, but there's no snow right now, so I seem to be having trouble sitting down. But it definitely is still a consideration. I better get this thing done sometime, or my wife is going to kick me out of the house, I think. So.
Well, it's always a pleasure. You're back on August 16th, so we'll do this all over again. Thank
Sounds
you,
good.
Phil. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. Great to have him along. I will be on my way to Green Bay tomorrow, but we have a show. Our guest makes the case that healthy eating can be delicious and inexpensive. Thanks for listening. Please stay with us.